Welcome to In Detail, the show where we take you behind the scenes of creative business. You're here with me, Mick Maloney, and my co-host, Kate Fitzgerald. Hi, Kate.
Hey.
And Warwick Mahaley.
What's up? I normally say
enthusiastic,
hello. But I decided to switch it up for episode 4.
Well, welcome, listeners, to In Detail, where we are taking you behind the scenes with creative business. I've said that bit. If you're joining us for the first time, go back to the start, you sociopath.
Can I interrupt you? I was in Adelaide recently giving a talk and I met someone who said that he loves the show and shout out. And he then went on to say the very first episode that he listened to was that episode where you last said that. Said, if this is the first episode, but go back,
sicko.
You sociopath.
Go back, you sicko.
Anyway, please continue.
Yeah, no, that's it. That's my intro. That's all I've got.
Surely there's more.
We're a bunch of architects.
Yeah, we want to thank some people and whatever, but we'll do that later.
We'll do that later.
Yeah.
Okay. We're just three architects, you know, going about our business. And we want to talk
kicking
about
goals.
It. Yeah.
And what are we talking about today?
We're talking about I was gonna say white knights, but that is not
we're not even using that. You don't use the White Knight title, then we can't refer to Ted Lasso and say barbecue sauce.
Ooh.
Okay, you mentioned there was a meme on our thing, but I can't actually even remember the bit.
Oh, my God. That's when Rebecca says, what are you doing, Ted? And he goes, I think it's called a white knight or something, but I think I've got this.
Barbecue sauce.
Barbecue sauce.
Barbecue sauce.
Yeah.
I love that show, but I can't remember it.
Oh, you're going to have to go watch it. I think I've watched the darts thing on YouTube like 8 gazillion times. Anytime I'm trying to suck
someone
in.
Oh, wait, it's on that episode.
It's the darts episode. Yeah. It's when he lines up for the bullseye at the end, and that's when he says barbecue sauce.
That's pretty cool.
Barbecue sauce.
But also, he's white knighting for Rebecca, so that's where I'm going, you know.
So we're talking about.
So wait, at this point.
Can you elaborate for our listeners? Because no one else is. I don't understand what we're talking about.
At this point, right, the listener knows what this title of this podcast is called. More so than we do, because we haven't decided on it. But they'll know because it'll come up in the podcast episode description. So right now, you know what this is called. And we don't.
Dear listener, and we don't.
So if you could write to us at in detail. No, that won't work.
Unless you do want to go, bacon savers isn't bad. And it isn't related to the Ku Klux Klan, which is also really
that's,
good.
That's way better than the Klan.
Yeah.
So we're going to tell you about some of the things that we've learned along the way from people who have saved our bacon, people who've given us advice along the way.
And specifically some terms and conditions that we have added to our client architect agreements that have evolved our client architect relationships. I mean, look, some would call this the school of hard knocks because, you know, we've all grown up on the streets. The architectural streets and these.
We are also just, you know, white university educated.
That's also true.
Middle class Australians. Really middle class
Australians, professionally educated. These terms and conditions, though, are all invariably hard won, I think hard is what won. I'm trying to point out.
They may not also. They're not always T&Cs either. Sometimes they're just like gems of – like I mean, they do often wind up in a T&C, and that's kind of a good place to start looking for these things. But they're also something that – they're also things that we've just maybe got advice off from a mentor or a friend or whatever that's really come through for us at some point and saved our bacon, I guess.
Okay. Yeah. So they come with anecdotes as – dear listener, you know we love a good anecdote, and they also come with some practical, I guess, some practical bits and bobs that you can hopefully sort of learn from. Because I think the whole point here is that some of the hard-won lessons have not necessarily been our own hard-won lessons. Some of them have come to us from others, and so I guess for that we've been grateful. I'm certainly, I know for some of the ones that are on the list here from that have come through me, that we haven't ourselves at Mahaley Slocum had to kind of generate ourselves, have come through others. And so I think that's the whole point here, that we're kind of paying it forward as we like to do. So who wants to kick it off?
Well, why don't we just run through from our examples? Let's
start of a list. Kate, this first one is one that you've added to the list. Go for it.
Is it the big rescue, the big financial rescue?
Have you got
the You don't have the list up.
I do not have the show notes.
Best podcast on the internet, people.
The mobilization fee.
Okay, so this one's you, Woz.
What do you mean?
From you. This is from the podcast. This bacon saver.
Yeah, but
you were the one who added it to the list. So
yeah, I know. But I just wanted to point out that how cute it was that it came from this podcast.
Oh,
I know. So I actually instituted the mobilization deposit for a project a little while ago, and it was a really big project. And it was a brand new client, and we were kind of taking a bit of a risk on this one because it's a different type of industry or different type of project to what we normally do. And the thing I did to de-risk it was to put the mobilization fee in, which is, I think we talk about it in season one. And it is basically a refundable deposit that you return to the, you take from the client at the beginning of the project. So it's 5% of the fee or $5,000.
By refundable, do you mean non-refundable?
It's refundable if they do the job, right?
If they finish the job.
If they finish the job, whereas if they fire you halfway through or just decide, you know, to buy a caravan instead of doing the project or whatever it is, they don't, you know, they don't get it back. But in this sense, it was a deposit that we hold to mobilise our practice to do the project ahead of schedule. And we were intending to return it to the client. And in this particular situation, that client was unable to pay us for a significant period of time. And basically, because we had that mobilization deposit, which meant that always our invoices were being front-loaded, especially, we were able to sort of, we hadn't done more work than we could pull out of that deposit. If that makes sense.
And so you were never behind, is what you were saying?
We were never behind. So even though our bills weren't being paid for a little while, we were never behind. And it saved our bacon big time.
Yeah,
it's gone.
And now we always do it with all our projects.
Yeah. Kate, can you talk turkey on the numbers?
Yeah, I guess so. It was a $35,000 deposit.
Whoa. Jesus.
Jeez, on a $600,000 house. Jeez. Pretty rough, mate.
Well, you know, you want to work with Whispering Smith and you
you must be at least this tall to ride.
I believe it wasn't a $600,000 house, though.
It wasn't a $600,000 house, no. And it was a significantly bigger project than projects we've worked on in the past. And, you know, with a new client. And so we just kind of felt like it was fair and it never got questioned. And it saved us.
Yeah. Look, our deposits are sort of between the sort of the 5 to 10% mark.
Hang on. Sorry. I thought you said 5 to 10 grand. Yeah. 5 to 10%. It was 5%. So.
Yeah. And. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think we found that they're never. We are often in the red. Like you sort of. You often. Like they're never quite big enough to like always cover us for every unpaid invoice, but they're sort of enough to kind of take the sting out if, I guess, an invoice does go unpaid, which obviously you want to avoid. But it's such a, you know, I mean, it's such a logical thing to do.
It's a good bullshit detector as well.
Yeah, for sure.
No one... if you feel like you're being strung along by a client and then you say, okay, well, we've got our mobilisation fee, here's an invoice for it, we'll get that paid and then that secures your spot in our schedule and we'll start your project in 6 weeks like when we said we would. And if they don't pay, well, you don't have to waste more time chasing that one up.
Yeah. It also what it also did was bought us the breathing more bought me the breathing room to be able to work through that with the client.
As in work through the period where they weren't paying you?
Yeah. Instead of just being like, you know,
desperate,
I need the money, which, you know, like isn't a great way to go about doing that. It just enabled us to have those conversations and work through it in a really sort of calm, measured way. And I think, yeah, it saved us, really saved us.
It's brilliant.
Yeah, it's a good one. I think as one of the changes that we've made, and I couldn't even tell you now where we got it from, like when, because we didn't use, it wasn't one that we used to do, but it was one that's sort of ancient history now for us, but it was such an easy change and one that met zero resistance and has been so like universally like easy to implement. So, you know, I think a lot of the other ones we're about to kind of go through are kind of much more complex and maybe a bit geeky and sort of very architectural specific, but the idea of a deposit or a mobilization fee would apply, I think, to any consultancy, effectively any sort of creative consultancy. It's, yeah, you know, I can't recommend it highly enough.
In your experience, have your consultants, like branding consultants or graphic designers, charged a similar mobilization fee?
I think almost all of them.
Okay.
I have never seen anyone charge a mobilization fee before. I've never seen it. Like, as in, they might charge a portion of the work up front, but this is not that. This is like an upfront payment that you refund, which is kind of, it's like a builder's deposit.
I think the shape of it might, like the T's and C's around it might be different.
Yeah.
But the idea of you paying something before work gets done, when that money sort of gets, sort of how it gets taken out of the overall fee might change from industry to industry. But the idea of paying money up front, I think, is super common.
Yep. All right.
It reminds me of Lionel Hutz's business card where it says works on contingency, no money down. And he's going, oh no, that's a typo. And he changes it to works on contingency, ? No, money down.
Exactly like Lionel Hutz.
Exactly.
Nice. Business. True business mentor.
But, I mean, it's a weird situation where you're, as a professional, providing a month's worth of credit to a client to say, okay, cool, we'll be your architects. Now we'll do $20,000 worth of work with a team of four people over a month and we just hope that you'll pay at the end of that.
Yeah.
Because you're our best friend. No, wait, you're somebody who worked in up the street and we don't know you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it sets the relationship off right, for sure.
Very professional.
Yeah.
And all.
Okay. Maybe it's my turn to ask about the next one.
We started with mobilization fee because that's at the start. And all of our listeners owe me $7,000, which is great.
We're mobilizing this podcast.
That's right.
It goes around $8 million.
That's right.
Tell us about... Oh, this is a really good one, actually. I think I'm going to implement this. Tell us about the specific note on the drawing.
Mick, yeah, this is like this back to the very other end of the project now.
Yeah. So we've gone through, fast-forwarded to the end of the job. And your project, this one came up. I was talking to a mate, Nathan Porter, who's an architect up in Ballarat, good bloke. And I was stacking some wood and having a chat with him the other day. And we talked
you
about.
You rural guy, you.
Oh, no.
Such a rural.
We're in our RM Williams by our utes, we were stacking some wood. We'd rope some steers. And we talked about, you know, I asked him, have you got any gems that I can use on the podcast? And he said, one that I love is a note in the terms and conditions and also making it very abundantly clear in the tender documents that variations need to be pre-approved. And it seems like basic, you know, contract 101, but when you're dealing with a construction project where you've got the head contractor, builder, but also a lot of subcontractors. And we actually have the exact same clause in ours, and we're sort of comparing notes on how good it is to make everybody aware of it. But basically on the front of MyNeurectics drawings it says, the work that you're doing is covered by the building contract and it's described in the architectural drawings. If you do work that's beyond that scope and that's not shown in these architectural drawings, make sure that you get approval to do that first. Otherwise, in red, you may not get paid for it. So that's basically sort of covering you against people who would otherwise extend their own scope off their own bat and then send you a bill for it afterwards. And I think you used an example, Kate, of, you know, if somebody turned up to site and saw some materials or something that were not, you know, properly covered from the weather, and they took it upon themselves to take that and maybe move those materials down the road to a warehouse, and then they send you a bill for their time and for the warehouse fees. Now, that's a really good thing to do and it makes a lot of sense, but it wasn't a pre-approved variation to the contract, so therefore that is not something that's just a straightforward thing that the architect can then approve. Yeah, so that's a bacon saver from our point of view.
Yeah, I think it's a good one. I think if you're working with builders who are very familiar with ABIC contracts and working with architects, it's basically something that almost never comes up.
Never comes up.
Because they just know the deal. But yeah, for builders who are new to the game, yeah, I mean, we have dealt with that in the past where builders say, here's a variation for something I've done, and you're like, whoa. Like that whole sentence has problems with it because you're like, well, you're now giving no choice. There's no opportunity to say yay or nay, which is the whole point of the conversation. It's something that's supposed to happen in the future. And, you know, the client might say, no, I'm happy for my materials to get rained on, which might be a stupid decision, but it may be
their materials and their decision.
It's their materials, correct. So.
Riddle me this, Kate, and Was. Are you familiar with the MBA contract variation clauses?
Not super well.
Well, we don't administer that contract, so that's probably fair enough. But I think there's some bullshit in there about if the variation is less than a certain percent, like 5%, the builder can just do it and send you a bill.
Really?
Well, I'm pretty sure that's how every variation works pretty much, because the variation doesn't get approved. There's no third party approving or rejecting a variation. It's just
direct to the client.
Here's
what? So even if it's $1 million variation, the builder can do it, approve their own variation, and then send the client the bill.
Well, maybe that's why there's that percentage limit. I mean, we're sort of speculating here. But, yes, it would make sense that there'd be a limit in place. But
fuck. I mean, golly.
Some salty language there. And that's why you hire an architect to administer your contract. And
I mean, it's crazy. Like, it doesn't make sense that, that there would be that power imbalance, which is the whole benefit of the ABIC contract. You've got someone else looking out for you. But and this is a great example. And we're actually, we've got this happening on one of our school projects at the moment where the school is not used to dealing with consultant-based projects. It's kind of crazy. The builder and we are just shocked at the level of on-the-fly changes the school is making. We're not even really started, demo's not even finished, and we have changed almost everything, despite the fact that there was a full stakeholder engagement process. The school has been sitting on full construction set of drawings now for a while, and we are just wholesale making changes left, right and center.
That's chaos.
It's chaos. And it's like exactly what you shouldn't be doing, and we're trying to tell the school, look, this is not what should be happening. You've had the opportunity to look at things, and it's just, you know, I think probably the consequences of an uninformed a client, basically not understanding how the contract works and sort of continuing on, sort of blundering through the china shop despite being told just chill out and trust that your consultants have looked after you.
Yeah.
Is this maybe a good segue into one of these other dot points, which is limiting what's included in the monthly retainer for QA?
Oh, that's a big jump.
Ooh,
yep.
Nice.
Too big?
All right, no, I'm moving it up. Let's do it up.
Well, I mean, this is kind of a jumping, same sort of general topic, isn't it? But crossing into fees as well.
This one was yours, so you want to keep on going?
Sure. So we have recently, maybe not recently anymore actually, but we're now shifted to a monthly retainer, which I know you have as well, Mick, for the construction phase.
Us too.
Oh, you as well.
Definitely the better way to go.
All of us. And it makes a lot of sense for architects and for clients, I think, because that fundamentally the number one unit of measurement for work and for value that an architect brings to that work during construction is not the cost of construction, but is the number of months that the architect is working. So back what we used to do was we would include that phase in our percentage fee. But if you sort of think about it, you might say, right, by the time you get to that phase, you'd have like 30 grand left. And there was a 10-month build, so it was 3 grand a month. But what if that 10-month build stretched out to a 12-month build? Suddenly you've got 2 months extra of work for the same amount of fee. Or what if you had 30 grand of fee left and you had two builders, both of whom have maybe priced the job exactly the same, but one is offering to do it in 8 months and one is offering to do it in 12 months. And so you've got the architect now sort of subject to working for 8 months or for 12 months for exactly the same amount of fee. So there's like a great sort of difference in the amount of labor or work that needs to be done based for absolutely no good reason, totally outside of the architect's control.
And also given the current conditions in the building industry that we're experiencing with delays, et cetera, it makes sense to have that flexibility built in rather than having a fixed fee. And then like someone I spoke to once gave me the advice that there should always be a prolongation clause.
Yeah.
You know, that allows you to, if things get extended, to be able to deal with that. And give
which is basically not really that required if you just want a monthly retainer.
Not relevant. Exactly. Yep. Monthly retainer. Correct.
And so the limit, though, back to that sort of point about what stuff's included and not included on drawings, is it still makes sense, though, to have a limit there so that in the event that the client says, you know what, actually I want to do this massive other chunk of work, that you're not then expected for your $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 or whatever per month to then go and document this whole other garage or second story addition or gazebo or whatever and still do that within your $3,000 or $4,000 retainer.
It can also just be death by a thousand cuts on that though, because it can be like, oh, I just want to change this little thing and I want to change all the door handles and I want to da-da-da-da-da-da. And like you just, you know, you can end up really burning a lot of time changing documents, which you shouldn't really be doing as part of your CA fee.
Yeah, I have heard of some architects who actually don't include variations in their CA fee, just flat out say, look, I can't quantify that.
That's not a bad idea.
So I will do X number of site visits and I will do a progress payment claim.
Yep.
And I'll deal with X and number RFIs. Of RFIs because that's something I can quantify.
And keep track of the financials of a variation, but not actually do the variation work.
Correct.
Ooh, because, not bad.
Because essentially what we're trying to do with the fee proposal is to quantify the knowns, but then anything that's unknown, shift that into another bucket and transfer the risk. And some architects will absorb that risk and some architects don't want to do that. And one way of doing that would be just to shift to hourly rates. Mm. But if you don't want to do that or if there's no appetite doesn't want to do that, one way to do that is just to limit it and say, right, well, I'll either limit the number of variations or I won't do them. And I will do them, but I'll just charge for them separately.
Mm.
Two more things I want to add onto the monthly CA discussion is... I vary or I'd like to vary, something that I sort of on my to-do list of for my T's and C's is to vary the fee depending on the builder. Because I've noticed that if you work with a first-time builder who's never used ABIC contract before, you can spend a shit ton of time explaining how this works and basically, you know, helping them with, you know, their responsibilities.
And a spreadsheet from 1998 that they haven't updated for the last 30 years.
So we'll say to clients, look, you know, we can give you a bit of a guide. This is what I'm hoping to say to clients is that we're going to give you a guide of how much it would usually cost, $5,000 a month, say, for a house, a basic house. If it's a, you know, $2 or $3 million house, it might be $8,000 a month. It might be more expensive because it's going to be a lot more complicated. But depending on what particular sort of client you have, which sort of builder you have, you can vary that fee to say, okay, if it's a specialist architectural builder that's going to build your house, we have to do a lot less work. And that's in terms of even on-site work, explaining things, you know, really articulating design intent, book work,
drawing through a pile of crumpled up receipts in an envelope as a claim.
Crumpled up drawings.
From seven issues ago.
Wrong drawing issues. Fuck. So there's the two things. Is one, what sort of builder it is, and then the other one, what sort of project complexity. And I think that a really simple job, like the probably the cheapest we've ever done was $2,000 a month, because it was a really straightforward small scale reno, and we found that that was all that the time was sort of all, you know, what the project required. But probably the most we've gone to is probably $8,000-ish. And those clients said, ooh, we don't like that, and did their own contract administration. But we did the numbers on it and we worked out that we couldn't have a staff member with sufficient seniority and experience to be devoting time. And this is a very complex site, building on three boundaries, underground car park, lots of complications. We couldn't possibly allocate a staff member to that project for less than that, because that, and that was basically cost for their time.
I mean, I've heard of architects at sort of the upper end of the residential market doing it at $15,000 a month.
Hard. Wow.
And when you sort of work that, if you work that backwards, I mean, that's probably, I mean, that's easily a full-time architect per month.
Yeah.
Easily, plus their, you know, on costs and whatever.
Yeah.
That's probably not like necessarily even that profitable. I mean, it may be at that level, but it might just simply be it's incredibly labor intensive to like manage the barrage of RFIs coming at you at, you know, for a sort of a $10 million house or something. I don't know. I've not done that sort of work.
See, $10 million house, you can't charge $4,000 a month. It's not going to work. Do you guys make money on CA?
No.
No.
It is.
But we do it so that the project doesn't suck and that we can.
And reduces your risk as well. It's an insurance policy.
Yeah. See, I don't know. I chatted to my lawyer about this and said, you know, in a project that we didn't do CA on and something went wrong, and I said, oh, look, you know, should we be worried? He said, were you administering the contract? I said, no, they're doing it themselves. He's going, don't worry about it.
Hmm.
But then this is not legal advice.
Do not take
that. We are not lawyers.
Though, I mean, we don't have this on our list, but partial contract administration is something we are now backing away from massively.
Yeah.
And we're almost, we've now basically arrived at the decision that we're just not going to touch it anymore.
Who's the senior architect guy who does the park course? Is it?
Brian Miller. He's not doing it anymore.
Tip of my tongue. He said that there's no such thing as partial contract administration services. And basically, once you're in it, in for a penny.
From a risk perspective.
Yeah.
From a liability perspective.
Because the liability perspective, you know, if you're going on site for an hour, you know, you might as well get paid for the whole thing because you're taking in the can for the whole thing.
Yeah,
for sure.
We don't document if we're not going to do the CA.
Oh, ooh. You package deal them. Ooh. We don't tender. We won't tender if we're not doing CA because it burns our bridges with the tenderers. And it's just like, well, you know, you're using all of our guys and contacts. But I haven't heard of people who won't dock.
What's your logic with that, Kate?
I just think that there can be, especially if it's not a good builder. I've seen it happen before. Not a good builder, and you do the documentation and not the CA, then that builder and in this project there was a terrible, terrible project manager, and that project manager just blamed our drawings for everything. And then we got hauled up to site and we're like, pushes. There are all these problems. And I'm like, those are RFIs that have gone unanswered because you refused to pay for CA.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think this is the whole problem about not being involved with contract administration, that I think what maybe a lot of clients and possibly even a lot of builders don't understand is that we're building a prototype every single time. This is not like a set of Lego instructions where all you have to do is follow steps 1 through to 140 and you'll get exactly the same outcome perfectly every single time. The drawings are even really good drawings, and we pride ourselves on our drawings. We think our drawings are really, really incredibly well resolved, but they're not 100% well resolved. They're 95%, but there's still like 5% where that has to be, as you just said, Kate, they're your RFIs. There's the final resolution. That's what contract administration is all about. That's answering those questions on site, coming up with those last little bits to make sure that what happens on site, you know, marries with the spirit or the intent or whatever of the design that has led up to that point. And so, I mean, that's a really interesting suggestion that I've never, ever thought of before, that if we're not doing contract admin, we not do documentation?
Well, you can just get a drafty to dock it up, can't you?
Well, obviously then it's going to be like nothing like we would have expected. But we've seen, we've done drive-bys.
I'd argue that they'd wreck it anyway at that point without you on CA. But that could be, you know, maybe when we're different.
Yeah. We've been involved recently with a couple of sort of disappointing projects where the client has taken the project and decided not to get involved with us during CA. And we've done a few sort of sneaky drive-bys out of sort of morbid curiosity. And morbid being sort of the operative word, because we've sort of driven past going, it looks mostly right, but I'm sort of, even from the street, you can go, oh, those rainwater heads are not at all like what we detailed and X, Y, and Z. And you just know that as soon as you sort of start walking inside, you'll just sort of, big chunks of your heart will sort of start breaking. And I'm sort of, I really want these places to get sold at some point so I can do a sneaky real estate agent visit, because I want to see what it's like. I know we're never going to get invited back, but I just know that the execution will not be up to scratch, and I can just imagine that we're getting blamed for these mistakes.
Of course you are.
Yeah.
It's yours, and you're not there to make sure it's, you know, delivered properly. Right. So. Correct. Yeah. If it's not yours and you don't document it and you don't invest your heart and soul in all of those details, then,
That's a fair point.
Two follow-ups on that. How do you guys deal with clients who come in at the start and say that they don't want you for CA? Don't take the job?
Well, that's what we're now saying, because we've been burnt enough times now with owner builders and so on that we're just like, you know what, it's just not for us. There are plenty of architects who do it, but it's more pain than it's worth.
Yeah.
And is that what you do, Kate?
Oh, totally. Take you all the way through to DA. Get you we'll do the DD and we'll do the TAM planning, you know, and then we'll hand it over as a package that you can get drafted up by someone else. And it's not a Whispering Smith project, but you get our expertise on that part of it.
Well, that was the second follow-up. How do you deal with authorship? You just say, here you go.
Not ours.
And it won't have your name on it. But
is that something you stipulate, Kate? That you'll say, we'll do it, but you're not allowed to say it's ours?
Yeah.
How do they feel put out by that?
We haven't had anyone who's even wanted that.
Yeah.
We probably weed them out already. But
what about the flip side of that, though? It goes off to Superdraft or Drafting. That's actually a real company. Don't forget I said that. it goes off to Drafting.
Who I'm sure are fine.
Drafting and Co. And
probably a
then
real company as well.
They turn around and go, look at our awesome building. We nailed it. Aren't we great design architects?
Well.
Or designers.
I mean, still not a Whispering Smith project. I mean.
But wouldn't that razz you if you put your sort of heart and soul into something?
Well, you don't put your heart and soul in it up to the point. Well, sorry, maybe that's our firm, but I don't put my heart and soul into it until I start documenting it. Sorry, I do put my heart and soul into doing the design, but it's still a broad stroke at that point, even right through to DD, you know?
We've had actually, if you imagine there's like a bell curve where architects leave projects at the end of sketch design and then someone else drafts it up and takes it off to execution, and you kind of have people who honour that sketch design and execute it actually really well all the way to like totally butcher it. We've had two projects that I've visited, just, you know, seen from the street type thing or seen photos of at both ends of that spectrum. And one where a builder took basically renders from SketchUp essentially and did a remarkably good job of honouring the intent, like really good. And we were really impressed with it. And I think it was probably because the clients were really switched on. They were lovers of design but just fundamentally couldn't afford the architectural pathway, and so just had to get a D&C type company to document it, get a building permit and build it for them. And there was a lot of – and essentially the design that we'd come up with relied heavily on carpentry, and I think what the builder was able to do was execute that carpentry. There was no sort of fancy metalwork. There was no none of sort of that complex stuff that was sort of relied on sub-trades. It was mostly just carpentry. They did a great job of it.
And so if you're a potential client, the takeaway listening to this podcast is that you should engage Mahathir Slocum to design the building, fire you, take it to a D&C. Is that where we go?
Well, we had since actually tried to approach that builder again on another project where, again, the client said, look, we love the design. We always knew there was a budget design challenge right from the beginning. We were really clear with the client. We always knew we're just going to take you up to into sketch design and then you'll go off on your own and take that design and go through this alternate pathway. Mm. And we helped them connect with this builder. That builder ended up wanting to basically charge exactly what we said it was going to cost to go through us.
Yeah.
So in the end,
none of this shit happens for free.
In the end, that builder was no cheaper than what we were going to execute anyway. So I don't know how that first client did it. So I actually don't know what the economics of it was.
I bet they paid anyway, I think.
Yeah. Anyway. But at the other end of the spectrum, we had another project executed by a builder, and literally they took our design and it involved some beautiful screening and some lovely brickwork and wrapped it in the cheapest, shittest cement sheet and nastiest brickwork you can imagine. It was like, it was the most horrible thing to look at. I could recognize our project, but it was like someone had vomited all over our design.
Wow.
It was incredible how badly executed it was. So go figure.
But anyway, this doesn't happen to you much, Kate.
Well, I just enjoy the early phases of it, and I think as a practice we're actually quite nimble and we're quite, you know, I feel like people get a lot of benefit out of us in those early phases, and I don't mind just doing those with people. And then, you know, and then they find a more cost-effective way of delivering that project. And it might be, so let's say it's a commercial office building or something, which, you know, we might be able to really like drastically improve how cool that building is by saying do this and do a minimalist front and blah, 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 and use breeze blocks or whatever it is that we decide is going to help them out. And they may, you know, they may be able to either get a drafty or even just go to a smaller but also significantly talented sole practitioner or something. You know, there are other ways to deliver that. Mm. And I think we're just a lot more free about how we do that now. But if someone wants to do a Whispering Smith project, then, you know, you're pulling out all the stops and we're doing it our way, and it's probably going to cost a lot for us to do it.
Yeah.
Season 3 of In Detail is generously supported by our good friends at Architeam. For our 2.5 listeners who aren't members, guys, tell us why they should join.
Yeah, well, if you like this podcast, then Architeam is like the much better version of it. It exists to share knowledge and to help smaller practices thrive.
Thanks, Architeam.
Thanks, Architeam.
Can we move on to the next one? And I might actually jump to one two below on our list, just because we're sort of talking about alternative arrangements.
Mm.
And Mick, this is one of yours. You've got this one about alternative arrangements and legal fees. What's that one about?
All right. So that one came via, I think, one of the smaller practice forums.
Mm.
And it was an architect, senior architect, talking about the tendency for some clients, particularly lawyers, to want to redraft the engagement terms or your client architect agreement. So they said, yeah, look, we've been, we've had this happen time and time again. So now we have a flat fee of $5,000 so that if you want to make any changes to our CAA, then you can pay us that $5,000 and we use that money to pay a lawyer to redraft the client architect agreement, so that we don't end up sort of doing it ourselves, which is a legal document. And I think it was a really good idea. So we've actually incorporated that into our CAA, and we haven't put a $5,000 limit on it. We've just said, because actually I don't know how much it would cost, and it depends on the number of changes. So it could be, the $5,000 is a good deterrent to say, okay, well, if you just want to change one clause, it's going to cost you $5,000, don't do it. But if, like what's happened to us in the past, a client's come through with 20 plus changes, not a lawyer.
A fake lawyer, if you will.
A fake lawyer.
Please see season 2 episodes, Heroes and Villains.
So the fake lawyer comes in, wants 20 changes to the CAA because they've had it reviewed by a mate, and they've, the mate's gone, oh, we'll have a look at this. Oh, I'm a fake lawyer. I'll go and rewrite the whole thing. And we've just said, look, go back to Section 16 of our terms and conditions, and it basically says, should the client wish to engage Maloney Architects on different terms, additional fees will apply to cover our legal review expenses. So that's completely open-ended, and we'll take those 20 clauses to our lawyer and get a fee proposal from them to redraft the whole thing and negotiate that with you. And that'll be on, our lawyers, I think, $1,200 or $1,300 an hour. So, whatever you want.
Though, and I think this came up in episodes 5 through 8 of season 2 when we were talking about heroes and villains, is that not a red flag that if the very first thing a potential client does is want to edit the shit out of your client architect agreement?
Has been safely used billions of times by clients over Australia for eons.
Yeah.
But even if it's not, even if it's your own, like ours is obviously our custom one that we have used, that them wanting to undermine that with their own, I kind of mind a few bits and pieces, but if they wanted to rip the shit out of that and redraft it, I reckon that's a sign of lack of trust. Is it not a red flag to say, I don't think we're a good fit?
Well, that's exactly what happened. We didn't take the client.
Okay, there you go. Yeah. So in some ways, is kind of a red flag raising device.
Yeah, it's a bullshit.
It's not necessarily about charging the money. It's about causing the thing to be raised in conversation to then say, we don't think we're good for each other.
Yeah.
But even it might be that there's a fake lawyer in the background, like someone's daddy or whatever.
Yeah.
Mommy.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll take a look at your team. Have you reviewed the terms and you're like, oh, well, then maybe they feel like they're doing their due diligence and you just shut that down pretty quickly by explaining that legal documents cost money and if they want a new one, it'll cost money.
Yeah.
It's pretty easy.
But a legitimate attempt to protect your interests, say you work in some sort of, you know, like a school or something like that, and you're trying to say, okay, well, like, I understand that's the way you work, but really legislation requires that we do this, or, you know, if you've got a legitimate reason to need to renegotiate those terms, then that's business. That's absolutely fine. It's just that we shouldn't have to pay for that with, you know, incur expenses on our behalf. You know, it's reasonable for the client to have to pay for that to be redrafted by a professional. Whereas I think what you raised was is really important, that a standard, you know, say you're in a residential architectural situation and a client comes in and wants to rewrite the whole thing, well then, yeah, run for the fucking hills.
Yeah. Okay.
Who wants to go next? Oh, percentage fees. How do you calculate it along the way? I like that one.
Yes. I think that one was my one.
That was, yeah.
Yeah, so for a lot of architects who are on percentage fees, I think it's very clear at the beginning how you calculate that. You know, client comes to you and they say, I have a $500,000 or $1 million budget, and you sort of work out what your percentage fee is and away you go. And at the end, it's often really clear as well, because well, it depends on, you know, how the project finishes up, but it's very clear because it's sort of the final, often the final amount paid to the builder. That's the kind of the final cost of construction. But along the way, there can be, I guess, not complete transparency. And in the past, the wording in our client architect agreement wasn't 100% transparent, and we got caught out on it a couple of times. So I reckon having really clear sort of step-by-step, and this is really just about very clearly articulating how the budget gets, sorry, how the fee gets calculated step-by-step, and just being like incredibly robust in your language. And we now have a step-by-step. Okay, here's what happens. You have your client budget, and then that gets superseded as soon as you get a quantity surveyor involved, whether or not the client likes it or not, essentially. That once a quantity surveyor provides a legitimate third party approved blah, blah, blah assessment of the cost of the project, irrespective of whether or not the client thinks that's a fair summary, the fee gets updated. And then once a quantity surveyor gets replaced by a tender, again, whether or not the client thinks it's a fair thing. Because what the project is going to cost and how the fee is getting calculated, they're kind of two separate things. And I reckon they often get conflated because we conflate
one's,
them.
Yeah, one's based on the other.
Correct. That's the idea. Thoughts?
So I've got a billion things I want to add to that. Kate, do you have to jump in, or did you want to have a? Did you want to talk about yours?
Nah, man.
All right. So we spell this out in detail with our proposals, where we talk about the process, and basically a lot of clients are interested in how we work with QS, and we do talk about how we price the we have the price of the project priced by a professional estimator, quantity surveyor, at three stages during the project: end of concept design, end of DD, and as a pre-tender estimate. Cost plans B, C, and D for anybody who wants to go down that rabbit hole. So, interestingly, we always get asked, "Well, how do we start? How do we do concept design if we don't know, we don't have a QS cost plan to tell us what the project's likely to cost?" And we say, "Okay, well, you're not a cost estimator client. We're not even a cost estimator service, but we will establish a budget with you when you call, and we'll talk about, you know, what you expect to do and roughly the rough size, and that's basically to detect whether or not you're in our wheelhouse of the sort of projects that we do. We'll then talk about, okay, what's your aspirational budget? How much do you think you will spend on this project? And I say, I don't know, I'm going to spend $750,000. And in my mind, I'm like, well, I reckon it's going to be closer to $900,000, but, you know, I don't necessarily want to say to them, have a fight about this at this stage. We'll say, okay, cool. Well, the process we go through in our pre-design stage, and this is something that Anthony Martin went into great detail at the last Archie Team conference, which was cracking. and we talk about, you know, what spaces they require. And as part of our pre-design work, we'll come up with a pre-design cost estimate or budget. And that then informs the concept design work that we do, which is around square metre rates and that sort of stuff.
We call that thing a budget advice letter, and we now make the clients acknowledge it.
Ooh,
and
nice.
We're even thinking about making them sign it.
Ooh, yeah. We presented on the last page of this pre-design presentation, and we've had one client say that they kind of blanked out at that point when we sent them a bill, because we said, here we go, we've presented this to you and you've agreed to it, that's great. And so we then use that figure that we've all agreed to, that's how big the building is that you want to build, and this is roughly what it's going to cost. And then we take that figure and then we update that automatically in your invoicing. They're like, what? I don't remember this figure at all. They claim that they just missed it. But it's kind of the most important thing. And I reckon you're right, Kate, getting them to acknowledge it and to sign it off is probably a really good idea.
The regular invoicing does help on that front, doesn't it? Because
yeah.
The number's there each time you send an invoice out.
I think from a business perspective, we're talking about a minimum viable product that we're trying to get the client's brief into a rough shape where we can attach areas to it and a rate. You know, you might base it on a couple of previous projects. You might call some architects to find out what the rough rate of that project's going to be. And you say, actually, if we put a bit of science behind this, we're looking at this many rooms, this rough area, this sort of allowance for circulation, and therefore this sort of raw cost. But, you know, big asterisk, this is subject to a QS review. But at least it allows you to do concept design based on a real fair estimate rather than the client's idea or their aspirational idea of how much they want to spend on the project, which may actually bear no resemblance to real life. And then from that point on, because we explain all this up front, we just get the QS to do the cost plans through the project, and then we take that number and we discuss the cost plan with the clients and say, okay, the QS has come back in, they reckon it's going to be 1.05 million, you've set your budget at 850, or our aspirational budget slash, you know, the budget that we worked out in pre-design is 850. And then we'll say, here's $250,000 worth of, sorry, 200 grand's worth of cost-saving ideas that we've come up with, so that we can bring your QS cost plan back down to the budget that we talked about. You know, this is a bad case scenario, but that sort of thing, you know, is frequently required. You get a bit ahead of yourself and you design, you get a bit excited and say, oh, cool, we're going to have the whole thing with the brick roof. And then QS comes in, shatters your dreams, and you say, you know what, we can have a steel roof and we'll get rid of the brick roof. And that puts the client in the driver's seat, and it allows them to then change, you know, whether or not they want to proceed with that and increase their budget or make those changes and go back to the original fee. Anyway, long story short, when we do that with the clients and they're in the driver's seat with their budget and they finally sign off and say, yep, that's what we want to do, we then just automatically update that on the invoices. We don't even talk about it because they've already agreed to that budget. And that updates all the stages so that at the end of the day, they've paid our percentage fee based on the budget that they want to proceed with.
Mm-hmm.
Drops mic, walks off stage. Wow, longest good answer one from Maloney yet, I think, on the podcast.
What about you, Kate? More to add?
No. I think that's pretty sufficient.
I think that's where we're going to wrap it.
Cool.
Stay tuned for part two next episode of Saving Bacon.
Bacon Savers.
Bacon Savers. Bacon, baking, baking, saving. Bacon saving. Baking, bacon saving.
Very good. Well, thanks for joining us at In Detail. You can check us out at our website, which is www.indetail.show. Listen to us wherever you get your favourite podcasts. We're on Spotify or on Apple Podcasts things. Is that what it's called? Apple, yep. We're on Twitter. You know, we frequent. No, we don't really tweet, but follow us there. A big thanks to the gorgeous Sean Gorman for our wonderful outro music. Thanks, Woz. Thanks, Kate.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys. Can I just say before we finally wrap that, Mick, that outro just rolled off your tongue like honey.
Yeah, I've been taking radio lessons.
For reals?
Welcome back. No, I whatever I say really close to the microphone sounds amazing.
No, but just like you just it's like you just you were reading it off a script almost.
Yeah. We should beautiful. Have an outro script.
We do have an outro script. It was beautiful.
Really? Anyway. What?
It was emotional as always, guys.